In the future, custom user interface design will largely go away, at least in the way that we know it now. It will first disappear from user interfaces on industrial machines, library systems, and scientific devices. But not long after, custom UI design for websites and apps will just vanish. Instead, user interfaces will be automatically generated at runtime. I informally call this kind of system an auto-generating user interface system, or an AUI. This series of episodes is going to track my progress developing an AUI system and all the challenges that I meet along the way. I'm Matt Queen, and this is The Design of Complex Things. Design visionaries love to go on social media and then pontificate about the future of computing. And while they're waxing poetic on their novel view of the future, they're basically describing what Geordi LaForge did on every single episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Computer, access correspondence files, Lieutenant Aquiel Unari. Computer, run me a subsystems diagnostic with a frequency range of 10 to 100 megahertz.
And that show aired in the 80s. Like, did you never see it? The show anticipated a lot of modern technology, like ubiquitous touchscreens, voice command, and now the AI chatbots that help us find and summarize information. But many people miss the real complexity of the Star Trek computers. So if you ever watch the show, the ship's computer system was called LCARS, the Library Computer Access Retrieval System. And characters on the show would ask the computer to display some data or information.
Pattern match found.
Specify.
The number blocks are mathematical representations of fragments of deoxyribonucleic acid strands.
Computer, connect the DNA fragments according to protein link compatibility.
And it would pop up on the screen in real time. And then they would tell the computer to add some other information and cross-reference this and that.
Computer, highlight the section of the missing pattern.
And the UI would just reconfigure itself to best fit and display the info that's being shown. And it would even provide new actions and capabilities based on the request and the actions that the user took. The LCAR system was auto-generating the user interface on the fly based on what it was being asked to do and what the user was doing with it. Auto-generated UI systems, or AUI, are inevitable. And you can see the appeal for software developers. The entire UI is just done for them, like a plugin library. Design systems like Material or Carbon and Fluent are all anticipating this kind of thing. And how fast these design systems have spread to the web and mobile app design should be an indicator of how big the AUI wave will be when it hits. I'm not trying to pontificate like a thought leader here, but just like the machine learning and artificial intelligence hit, AUI is going to change the landscape of software design when it hits its maturity. And on the other side of that AUI wave, you're not going to be in Figma designing screens and views to hand to a developer for them to try and build it. Those days will largely be over. Automatically generating UIs, or AUIs, have been a research topic since like the 80s. A couple of examples of AUI systems are Mytopia. This is from Mitosystems. It's a knowledge mapping system that needs to create a UI view based on previously undetermined collections of data types. So a record could have images, locations, and audio files in the knowledge-based system, and then you'd be able to add more and edit the information that's there, snippets of text, audio files, video files, and that sort of thing. Another system is called Huddle. It's a user interface system for using grouped sets of smart applications and home devices. So you've had this problem before where you've got two remotes for your TV, one for the TV and one for like your TiVo or something, and you want to adjust the volume on which one and which one do you use. Well, the Huddle system would go and discover tasks like volume control with your myriad of devices, and then it would create an interface where you could adjust the volume in one place and it would affect all the systems involved. Another example would be a system called Supple. It's a UI controller that reconfigures the interface based on the cognitive and physical abilities of the user. So the user may have impairments that make it difficult to, say, select small items from a list, from like a small type and that sort of thing. So it renders the selection component as a large list of buttons instead of like a drop-down list. So I've been thinking about AUI systems for a while now, and I want to take a crack at building one. I want to create an AUI system where a user can fetch some remote data or just copy and paste it in, and the system will automatically create a UI to edit, display, analyze, model, and visualize the data, then save their session and perhaps even share that session with others. Not unlike the Star Trek LCAR system, but probably nowhere near as good. So that's a pretty tall order. But if we break it down into parts, we might want to do four things. First thing that we might want to do is detect and recognize the data type and the domain. That's mostly what this episode is going to be about. But the second thing we want to do is, from that, we want to derive known common activities. So if the data is inflation rate, then the activities might be to calculate currency amounts or predict future inflation rates. Then third, we want to map UI components and functions to data and activities of that domain. And then lastly, we just want to keep session logs of all the mutations that happen to the data and the preferences for this user. So if we just think about that first one, just detecting the data type and recognizing the domain. So like, what does that mean? Imagine that the data that we see is a string. It's a string of numbers. And it's 4-5 dot, you know, six digits, and then a comma, and then negative 11 dot six digits. Now, the strict data type, the observed data type, is a string. But on inspection of that string, we could look at its contents, and we see that it's a comma-separated list of two numbers. The first one is 45 dot blah, 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 and the second one is negative 11 dot blah, blah, blah. These numbers could be anything. It could be XY coordinates. These could be elevations. These could be stock price changes. Determining what the data actually is would be detecting the domain of the data. So we could test our string of two numbers and determine if the first number is between negative 90 and 90, and if the second is between negative 180 and 80. And we might conclude that it's actually a GPS coordinate. So that would help predict the domain of the data. If the data were an array of GPS points, we might make further conclusions about the best way to display the data, like it might be on a map, and what operations can be performed on it. Like we might have some sort of spatial analysis, etc. At large, we're trying to extract the ontology from the data. So ontology in computer science is a set of components that fit in to form the ontology of the data. So the components are things like the parts of it. So are these the rows in the table, the files in a directory, the sample GPS points? And then it's the types. So this would be, I mean types kind of like almost categorical. So this would be, is it good, medium, or bad? Is it manually collected GPS points versus auto-collected ones? And then we might look at attributes. These would be parameters like name, color, temperature, salinity, pressure, or a timestamp. And then there'd be relations that would be part of the ontology. And this would be how all of the classes and attributes relate to one another. An ontology has axioms or rules that govern how all of the attributes and relations fit together. So, for example, it may be true that only one element can have a given attribute at a time. So, for example, only one employee can be the CEO. So that would be an axiom of that data in that domain from that ontology. And lastly, ontologies have events attributed to them. And this would be related to the state of the application. So if you, you know, if you use software, as the data changes, as you've made updates to it, it maintains a certain state. Or if you're in this mode of the application, it has this state. And this is all governed by events that trigger inside of the application. So all of these fit into an ontology. So to auto-generate the UI based on the ontology, We have to start with what you can glean just from the data alone. And this gets back to our string. This can be pretty tricky, depending on what the data actually is. Our string of two numbers is pretty straightforward. There's a high likelihood that that's a GPS point. But if we imagine a case where it's not, suppose we have a data set where the part that we see, the observation that shows up, is an object, and it just has some key value pairs in it, where there's a name, you know, Jane Doe, there's an age, 44, there's a city, Bozeman, and there's a state, Montana. This looks like a record of a person, maybe in a contact database or something like that, but it's somewhat difficult to grasp the ontology of what's happening here. We have a sense of some of the components. For example, by virtue of the fact that a state is present, we know that the city, Bozeman, could be other cities inside of Montana. So there's some ontology points that we could glean from the data alone. However, imagine if it changes just a little bit. Changing the city from a single string, Bozeman, to an array of strings. So imagine if it was, instead of city equals Bozeman, cities, and it was Bozeman and Seattle. Now, the ontology of the data changes considerably at that point, because if we have two cities for a person, are these last known locations? It's kind of hard to tell. Are these office locations that this person works in? The meaning or the ontology inside of the data changes considerably. So if we get into decoding, recoding, and embedding, which is ultimately what we want to do, decoding of the data type in the domain happens in layers. And I kind of described this before, but if we go back to our GPS point example, the first layer is the input data type. It's what is the data type we actually see? So we would see it's a string. The second layer is a native type. So as I had said before, it's a string, but we could easily see that this is a set of numbers. We could parse this and determine that these are numbers, and we could split it on a comma and see that, it's actually a list of numbers. So its native type is an array of floating point values. Then we get to the third layer, which is the complex business of matching the pattern of the native type to the known domain definitions. This is the is the number between certain values to determine whether this was a GPS point or not. And we can't rely on simple pattern matching tests. Most data is going to match for multiple patterns. So this thing that we're saying is like, this is a GPS point. These could be two stock price changes, as I described before. They could be elevations. So we could come up with tests for every single known data type, and it's going to match for multiple. But we won't really know which one is the quote-unquote right one. So our pattern tests need to be deep, encoding not only the format of the data, but the classification of the data. So there's another layer on top of this that we need to figure out. And that is, we need to look at the data and say, is this categorical data? And if it is categorical, is it nominal, ordinal, or dichotomous, like male, female, or active or inactive? Is it quantitative or and continuous? And above that, we need to surmise usage qualities of the data. Is it a collected value? Is it an experimental value? Is it commonly an independent or dependent variable? Is it a predictor or an outcome? All these qualities together aim to capture the ontology of the data. And what we're aiming at here is to come up with a set of layers, a set of tests that would extract the ontology pattern from the data itself. So then we have to encode all this information in a data structure that represents the ontology pattern that we're testing for. So we might have a set of tests that tell us that this is a GPS point, and it would be the things that we've discussed so far. And this multi-dimensional set of features and tests start to look like a collection of tensors. So in machine learning, tensors are multi-dimensional objects that store feature-like data. It's the data like we're talking about here with our data in the ontology pattern, transforming our ontology pattern into a model of tensor layers. When we take the layers that we've talked about, where we're saying what is the observed type, what is the native type of the data, and then we have these tests for whether it's, say, a GPS point or something like that, these layers, and we put those into tensors, and then we organize these tensors into a model, that process is called embedding, creating an embedding. For an example of the power of tensors, let's suppose you are embedding words. So let's think about embedding the word bank in a tensor. We could train our model for the word bank by feeding it 1,000 sentences that use the word bank and then running them through a sentence diagramming algorithm that detect the parts of speech, like the subject, the object, the verb forms, that sort of thing. And in the end, we could pass a new input sentence to the trained model that uses our bank tensor layers, and we might be able to determine differences between sentences, like he stopped 10 feet from the river's bank, and it would pick up the word bank with a certain meaning. And then if we fed it a different sentence, he stood 10 feet from the town's bank, completely different use of the word bank, but if we trained our model properly, it would be able to sense nuanced differences between those two versions of the word bank. We could feed it a different sentence. He attempted a 10-foot bank shot. So with those thousands of sentences that we fed into our layers of tensors for our model, we could determine differences between those sentences. You're probably familiar with this from ChatGPT or Google's Bard and chatbots that you've no doubt been messing with. So what we want to do is encode all the aspects of a particular data type ontology as an embedding in several tensor layers. Then we want to compose them into a model, train that model on existing data examples, all so that we can pass it a new piece of data, and then it can give us a match or no match for the data type ontology and a confidence score. Okay, so I created a little coded example of a trained model so you could see kind of how this would work in principle. Head over to the CodePen model linked in the description, and what you'll see when this loads up is there are 3 points, and there's a kind of an XY plot, and the curve, there's like a pink curve, and it is fitting the points that are there. So if you're the uninitiated looking at this, this probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense of why this would be machine learning, but I'll break it down. The points are training data. And so the training data has allowed the model to fit this curve such that it goes through the points. It compensates for the training data. And just like we've been talking about these tests, like does it pass the test or not pass the test, just like our GPS points, does it fit that format or not? The way that you interpret these graphs is that the training points fit the curve, and the model then is set of these layers of tensors. And so this is a very simple example where there's two dimensions. There's an X dimension and a Y dimension. And so in this little concept example, those are tensors. So we have two tensors, and the model is showing this curve. If the new data point that we feed it, like our new string that has the GPS points in it, if we feed that to it and the point ends up being underneath the curve, that would be a positive match. So if this whole setup, this graph, represents the test of whether this is GPS points or not, and the point that we fed it falls underneath that curve, we could say, yes, this is a GPS point. If the point instead falls above the curve, so outside of the curve, we would say that's a no, that's not a match. In addition to that, we could say the distance from the point to the curve, that's our confidence. So if it falls above the curve, we'd say, oh no, this is no match. However, if it's really close, we would say, well, the confidence isn't really high, but it's still a no match. So what you're looking at on load of this little prototype that uses TensorFlow.js, by the way, is it's looking, and it just has 3 points. So the curve is trying to fit the 3 points. If you look into on the right side, there's a code panel there that shows all the source code that makes this work. And you look on line 4, you'll see I start the seed data. This is the number of training values that I put into the prototype. So on line 5, you'll see there's a seed number and it's set to 3. Try setting that to 30. You can just change the number to 30 and it will automatically update. And you'll notice that now the training data has been a lot more, it's filled in. You can see that it's almost starting to make a curve and then the model fits it as best as it can. So the value of having more training data is that the model is more solid. So in our case of each one of these data ontologies, they're not going to be, you know, just, you know, two tensors. They're not going to be just an X and a Y tensor, and they're simply not going to be like, you know, values like this, like, you know, X and Y values. In fact, a lot of them, like we've been talking about, have been Boolean. Like, does it match this pattern, or does it not match this pattern? So that would be a 0 or a 1. And so you're looking at a very simple example that's in principle how this would work, but it wouldn't be, we couldn't really easily visualize the sum total of all of our tensor layers for our ontology that we've been talking about this whole time. It'd be difficult to kind of visualize that all in one space because it's like, you know, several dimensions as we're trying to fit this curve in several dimensions and then determine whether it's underneath or above that and then get our confidence score from it. But that's in principle how it would work. One thing I want to show you about this, and we get into the crux of machine learning, is if you drop it back down to 3, drop the seed number back down to 3, so we just start with 3 points, the prototype will reset and you'll get a curve. Now you can also click on here to add points. So let's suppose that the 3 that are already there are the training set, and then you're going to add one more training set point. You can, when you click a new point, it attempts to reset the curve to compensate for your new training set, your new training point. So the curve is now different. That's the learning part of machine learning. And you can kind of just keep dropping in points to try and get it to fit the new curve. And you can kind of mess around with it and you can see how it responds. So as you just kind of click points around. So notice that you can get a large change in the curve if it only starts with 3. Now try jumping this up to 300. So take the seed number on line 5 of the code on the right panel there and jump that up to 300. So the prototype will reset and it will start with 300 values. Now you can see that the function that I'm using to identify the seed number training points is this bell curve. You can clearly see the bell curve now, and then you can see the model trying to fit that bell curve. Now try clicking points, way above and way below, and you'll notice the model doesn't change very much. The curve doesn't change. It's because it's already been trained on a really solid data set, and these random points that you put in aren't affecting the model that much. So what this shows you is that the value of the training set and how solid the training set needs to be. So the ontology needs to be encoded, embedded in our tensor layers, and it needs to be very solid because we're not going to have very much change. There's not going to be additional learning as the user goes in and says, oh, no, I don't want to see these GPS points as a map. I want to see them as a table and that sort of thing. So this is kind of an illustration of how this stuff works and the value of training and the sensitivity of a model after it's been heavily trained versus when it's been not so heavily trained. The take-home point is that we've been talking about these TensorFlow layers and these kind of ontology tests for various data ontologies and, you know, the domain of the data, like our GPS points. There's no way that I'm going to go in and create a set of ontology tests for every single data type and domain known to man. Like, it's just not going to happen. That's where machine learning comes in. See, what I want to do is I want to figure out a generic test for all the kinds of ontology components, and then I want to use machine learning to go and recurse into various sample data sets to figure out all of the information that I can glean from the pattern of the data that's presented itself, and then I want it to generate all of the curves for me for each of the data types. Then I'm going to use those as the tests. So I'm going to have machine learning learn all of the formats for me. Okay, so I'm going to show you one last prototype here. This is what I've got so far. So if we put all of these concepts together, where I have some remedial trained models and some basic ontology types being mapped onto data, you'll see in this UI, and this is my working model of my AUI system, you'll see I have a tab that says UI in the top, and then I have a tab that says data. So in the data tab, you'll see I have an editor here, and I can drop data in place. So for example, let's say that instead of this array of objects that I'm going to use in a second, let's say instead of that, I drop in a string, and it's just going to be a color. So it's FF3399, so it should be a color. If I hit the Build UI button, and I go to the UI, notice that it dropped in like a little color chooser, and it was set to that value. So it has learned the type for hex code color values, and it's mapped that remedially to a little color chooser. So if I go back to the data tab here, and instead I drop in this object, and you'll notice that it has name and Seattle, Bozeman, Duluth, it has populations, and it has states as locations. If I hit Build UI, and I look at what it did, it dropped in a table. So it recognized that array of objects as a table element. That's like the canonical form of the display of that particular information. So I drop in a string that's a color. It says, oh, that's a color. It learned that model, and it has a remedial mapping to the color chooser. In this case, it maps it to a data grid. And you notice I can sort and filter the table to show the information that was there. However, what if I slightly change it? So instead of the object there has the locations as the state names, let's suppose that I drop in almost the same data. It's just that I've given it a location, and instead of the state, I've given it some GPS coordinates in a string. So the same observed type, like the state name was a string, and this time the string is some GPS coordinates. And if I hit Build UI and I go to the UI, you'll see that it has learned this type as a map. It knows that those were GPS coordinates, and it has rendered a map to the screen that shows me those locations on the map. So this is a simple example of how all of these pieces fit together. We have some data. It passes it through some machine learning models in order to determine which type of data it is, to extract its native type, and then to have a remedial mapping to a UI object so they can drop it on the screen. So there's a long way to go, but that is an example of how we get through that first of four layers of just detecting the type and trying to extract the ontology from it. The next step is going to be undertaking the large effort of training a model that has a more comprehensive set of data types and data formats. And that'll be the subject of the next episode. Thanks for listening.